You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on the Free Speech Television Network via Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable systems across the country. More people watch or listen to the Tom Hartman Program in more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. And it's Friday, so it being Friday in our first hour, it is Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. And Bernie, you're in the Senate, and you have a special guest on the phone.
I do. Tom, we don't often do this, but I wanted to bring a special guest on with us this afternoon because I think that as we look at the right-wing Republican House and know how difficult it is for the Congress now to protect ordinary working people, do the right thing environmentally, protect women's rights and so forth, it's important to look at what's happening at the statewide level. And I'm very proud that in my state, we have one of the most progressive governors in America, if not the most progressive governor, Peter Shumlin. And I wanted to bring Peter on the program today to talk a little bit about what progressive government can be doing at the state level. Peter, thanks for being with us.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be on. Thanks for inviting me.
Peter, let me just throw the question to you. At a time when we have right-wing control over the House, we have big money playing such a huge role in the political process, what is the state of Vermont doing to stand up for the values that so many Americans believe in?
Well, you know, we're doing some things here, Bernie, with your support and your help that are just not being done in other states. The first is we are passing and implementing the first sensible single-payer health care system in America, where health care is a right and not a privilege, where it's publicly financed, where it follows the individual. As a resident of the Green Mountain State, you will have Green Mountain health care, full coverage benefits, and publicly financed. And, you know, really it's being driven by two forces. One, we all know that we spend more money on health care in this country by 200, 300, 400 times than most of the other industrialized countries that we compete with for jobs and economic development. Yet we know that the rising cost of health care is unsustainable, and that we have too many residents who make horrid choices every single day about where they work, what they do, where they move, because of a need to have access to quality health care. So it's the right thing to do. It's an upward battle for the simple reason that our friends in special interests, I should say, in Washington did a pretty good job of precluding governors like me from passing single payer until 2017 when they passed the Affordable Care Act. But we will be ready in 2017 for the first sensible health care system in America. And as you know, with your leadership, we're making huge progress on not only energy efficiency, where we really lead the country in energy efficiency, but also in moving to renewables, getting off our addiction to oil. And we're seeing huge job growth as a result of it. We now have more green, clean jobs in Vermont per capita than any other state in the country. So we're putting together what I call the first sensible energy policy that's going to ensure that our kids and grandkids have a better chance of surviving in a climate in a planet that is challenged by climate change, which I think is our greatest challenge that we face.
Right. Let me just jump in and say to listeners that what Governor Shumlin is talking about is not only of great importance to the state of Vermont, my state, but it is of enormous importance to the country, because I believe that, in fact, as the governor just stated, if we can in Vermont put together a strong, cost-effective, single-payer health care system which guarantees health care to all people, the other 49 states will be looking at what Vermont did, and they're going to want to follow us. So this is not just an issue for Vermont. It's an issue for America. And I think the second point that the governor made about energy is also of enormous consequence. It is incomprehensible to me that at a time when the scientific community, the scientists who study this issue, believe that global warming is the greatest threat to this entire planet, we have a majority party in the House of Representatives who more or less believes that global warming is a hoax and that we're doing virtually nothing to transform our energy system. So I think, as the governor indicated, states like Vermont, California, other states that understand the importance of transforming our energy system are leading the way in helping to cut greenhouse gas emissions, but also, as the governor indicated, he might want to pick up on this point, creating jobs. Peter, what are we doing in terms of job creation by transforming our energy system?
Well, you know, they're absolutely linked, and I keep saying, Bernie, I know you agree with me, that, you know, in my view, there's two challenges. The first is, you know, because we're a cold state and because we have such stark four seasons, you know, I keep saying the cold states are going to see the effects of climate change perhaps before some of the other states in the country. And that's why we have such a heightened awareness here. You know, we've had extraordinary storms. Irene wiped out, we lost seven Vermonters. We lost Hurricane Irene. We lost, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of infrastructure, roads, bridges. We lost homes. We lost businesses. That's one example of our climate change affecting our state. So Vermonters, regardless of political party, recognize things have changed drastically in the last 20, 30 years because of our emissions. But I think the second point is, because we're harnessing the wind and the sun and our forests and our streams to biomass and our and small hydro, everything possible, combined with energy efficiency, we are emerging from this recession faster than other states. Vermont now has the distinction of having the lowest unemployment rate this side of the Mississippi. We have the fastest growth rate of any of the Northeast states. And in 2011, Vermont was the only state in America who actually saw income growth after a decade of working Americans seeing stagnant incomes, one of the biggest challenges we face. So the answer really is that not only is it the right thing to do, but those states, those governors, if Congress, you know, if that right-wing house of yours could get their act together, those that get there first are going to get the economic prosperity. I believe the transformation from an oil and coal-driven economy to one that uses renewables and alternative energy is going to make the tech boom and the industrial revolution look small. Huge economic opportunity as we do the right thing.
Peter, say a few words on Vermont's tradition and what we're doing now in terms of a non-discriminatory society and our belief in human rights.
Well, you know, we're the only reason that Vermont can have the good judgment of having a senator as great as Bernie Sanders is because we've always combined good common sense, what I call pragmatic fiscal caution, we pay our bills on time, with a sense of social justice. And it goes way back in our state. You know, we were the first state to abolish slavery. We were the first state to pass publicly funded public education. We were the first state, we invented civil unions, frankly, and the first state to pass marriage equality legislatively, not because a court and judges told us to do it, but because we knew it was the right thing to do. So it's a wonderful state, a great place for jobs. I think it's the best quality of life, best place to live, to work, to raise a family. But most importantly, we care about each other and taking care of each other in ways that you don't experience in other states. And I know that sounds kind of dreamy, but the fact of the matter is it's just true.
Well, we saw that, as I think many listeners know, Vermont was hard hit a year and a half ago with Hurricane Irene, and it did devastating damage to our small state. And the governor did a great job in helping to lead the state in rebuilding. And one of the things we have noticed is how many people came out to support their neighbors. So I want to thank Governor Shumlin very much for what he's doing and for being with us this afternoon.
Well, thanks, Senator Sanders, for having me on. Keep up the great work.
Thank you, Governor Shumlin, and thank you, Senator Sanders. We'll be right back with more here on Brunch with Bernie on the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, Senator Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your questions. And Kelly in Berkeley, California, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. You are on the air, Senator Sanders.
Okay, great. Thank you. I love your show.
Thank you.
Senator Sanders, you often talk about lifting the cap on withholding for Social Security to save Social Security forever. And I wondered how, if we lift that cap, how would that affect the benefits that are paid out? So if someone with $1 million salary is paying that FICA tax on the whole thing, does that mean that we would really lose what we gained by paying out bigger benefits?
No. I mean, if people who are earning $1 million are going to pay more into the fund, are they going to end up with some extravagant Social Security package? The answer is simply no. We'll have to adjust it and deal with that, but it would be absurd. Social Security is not a program to make people wealthy. The goal of lifting the cap is to make sure that Social Security remains solvent for the next 75 years. Right now, it is good for 21 years, at which point it pays out 75-80% of what we need. We got to fill that 20% gap, and the way to do it is to lift the cap. And by the way, you don't have to start at 113. You can start at somewhere around 250,000.
Donna in Palatine, Illinois, listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders and Tom. My question has to do with if you're calling in to your senator or your representative to express your views on different issues, and let's say you had two issues that you wanted to call in on, say the filibuster reform or gun control, does it have a bigger impact if you make two calls? Or can you just make one call and give both opinions on the same call? And, I mean, I was just wondering what kind of impact that has on the senator. And, I mean, how would...
Well, right. You know, it depends. You know, what happens is when you call, the person who answers your call will take notes and write down what you said. If you're concerned about two issues between you and me, it probably makes more sense to make two separate calls so that you can get registered for A and B. Sometimes the clerk who's answering the phone may just put down one rather than the two.
Okay. Tom, one of our podcast listeners in Canoga Park, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, that's me. Hi, Senator.
Hi.
I honor your courage to do this. I'm not even one of your constituents, and you're willing to answer perhaps a tough question. I'm going to make this really short and sweet, just a few sentences. My question is, how does the Senate decide what and how much of the defense budget to cut? Now, I've heard that not all senators are privy to the specifics of the various defense projects and weapons systems. It's kind of viewed as a security risk to have all the senators know all the details. But specifically, I'd like to know, how is the trust derived in your fellow senators who may be on one of those defense-related committees? Even if those senators are not from your party, and since you're an independent, none of them are from your party, is there essentially a black hole as far as the trust is concerned, and does that black hole coincide with a black budget? And my last sentence, how can you make a decision about the defense budget if you aren't even allowed to know the details about projects that may be black and consequently have black budgets?
Okay. Thanks, Tom. I suspect that there are all projects that are clandestine that do not go out of the committee. But I think that is much more the case with the Intelligence Committee. In fact, for a number of years, information regarding the size of the intelligence budget was not made public, although I think the media was close to guessing what it would be. So I think the question you're asking is much more appropriate for the Intelligence Committee, which is largely a fairly secret document. In terms of the defense budget, which will be somewhere around $600 billion, the largest budget of any government agency by far, I think we do know where most of that money in fact is going. My own view is that clandestine or otherwise, we can make judicious cuts in military spending, maintain the strong defense that we need, and yet save substantial sums of money. I would point out there is a massive amount of defense contractor fraud that takes place. There are a lot of overruns where companies come in and say, we'll build this weapon system for X dollars, and it ends up being substantially more. We have a situation where the military is contracting out in areas where in-house work and government employees could do that same job for substantially less. So to answer your question, much of the Defense Department, as I understand it, is in fact public information. We do know where it goes. I think it should be reduced.
Ryan in Spokane, Washington. Quick one for Senator Sanders. We have about a minute.
Yeah, absolutely. I just had a quick question. I'm a pipe fitter, journeyman for a union, and I install gas right up to someone's home. And my question is basically, with all the gas, natural gas that we have, and knowing that it's cheap to convert a car to natural gas, and knowing we could fill them in our garage, do you feel like there's a reason we're not using our natural gas? And if so, do you think this has anything to do with them, the government, actually trying to keep the middle class poor?
No, I don't think there is a lot of reasons why the middle class is disappearing. I don't think this is one of them. I think, as I understand it, there are now truckers, bus companies that are using natural gas. And I certainly think that it is something we should look at in terms of cleaner fuel for automobiles.
Okay. We'll be back with more of Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. It's a great news resource. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, his newsletter, and you can sign his amendment to the Constitution.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, of course, you can drop into TomHartman.com and for free participate in our blogs, our message boards, jump into our chat room, read our daily stack, all that kind of stuff. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Bernie, you're back with us?
You're right here, Tom.
Okay, great. Jeff, is it Minong, Wisconsin? Am I saying that right, Jeff?
Hello.
Jeff, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Okay, I was curious. It seems like the people that don't like abortion clinics and family health care, whatever, that kind of stuff, are the same ones that don't want food stamps and other things. But if we had health care and things for women so they wouldn't have more children, perhaps we wouldn't need people eating more food stamps.
Hmm. Well, Jeff, you make an interesting point. But I should say that I have always been pro-life, pro-choice, and believe that the issue about whether or not a woman has an abortion is the woman and her physician and not the United States government. But I always find it interesting that the so-called pro-life people worry very little in many cases about what happens to the kids who are born. And it's not just food stamps, it's child care, it's education. It seems to me that if one really were pro-life, one would want to make sure that our children have the kinds of upbringing and the opportunities that kids in many other countries around the world have. And sadly, that is not the case. Right now, in America, we have by far the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country on earth. Well over 20% of our kids are living in poverty. We have a horrendous situation with regard to child care. Many, many working families find it extraordinarily difficult to find decent quality, affordable child care, way behind many other countries in that regard. It would seem to me that if you're really pro-life, among other things, that when a woman had a baby, you would want to make sure that that woman and that father could stay home and nurture that kid during the first 4, 5, 6 months of life. Many countries have strong parental leave programs. We in the United States don't. As a matter of fact, there's an article in the last edition of the Bernie Buzz, our newsletter, that deals just with this issue and contrasts how we treat our kids and families as opposed to what goes on in many countries in Europe. And you can get that at sanders.senate.gov. But so that's my viewing. I think I find it hard to understand how there are folks out there who say, no, under no circumstances can a woman have an abortion. But when women do have babies, they really don't get the kind of support that they often need.
Yeah. And but that said, there's also a group called Democrats for Life. I am pro-choice, but there's a pro-life group of progressive Democrats out there. And the Catholic Church, many, you know, there are some real aggressive progressives right. in the Catholic Church who are pro-life, and they're like the nuns on the bus. You know, they're traveling all around the country. So
yeah, that is
true. It's really complex.
But it's true, but we don't see that type of attitude by and large here in the United States Congress. There are exceptions to the rule, but that is not the case here.
Lee in Hendersonville, Tennessee. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
How you doing, Senator Sanders and Tom? Great to be on your show. Senator Sanders, I know that Vermont is always out front on new and bold things, and with the potential to have a single payer that's coming down the pipe. Is it possible, since we can will soon buy insurance across state lines, is it possible to also buy insurance from Vermont that's a single payer?
I think not, Lee. The single payer will be limited to the 630,000 people in the state of Vermont. But we hope that by setting the example, by doing it right, by showing that you could provide quality health care to all of our people, and when you do that through a single payer system, you save substantial sums of money. You create a situation where you can control to a far greater degree than currently the escalating cost of health care, that when Vermont goes forward, it will become a model for the rest of this country. And I would hope very much that Tennessee and other states will not be far behind. But that's kind of where we are right now in Vermont.
Arlene in Pine Mountain, Georgia. You're on the air with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep. Yes.
I'm a long-time listener but first-time caller. And basically the question I wanted to ask was something you had already touched on about these gerrymandered districts. I just wanted to know what could be done about it. I mean, isn't it a subversion of democracy when the districts, they propose that they're going to try to even, you know, gerrymander them some more so that the many more people may vote, for example, Democratic, but they will still elect many more Republicans to the to their state houses and to the also to the you know, to Washington, and possibly even change the outcome of the next presidential election. I mean, what exactly could be done about that?
Arlene, that is an excellent question, and it's one, to be honest with you, that I can't give you the kind of answer you deserve on that. But it is a very serious problem, and I haven't thought through exactly what the remedies are. Gerrymandering, by definition, I think, Tom, that was named after a guy, the Revolutionary War period?
Yeah, I'm not sure when it was, but it was in the early part of the 19th century, late 18th century.
You know, so the concept of majority parties manipulating districts for their advantage is nothing new. It's gone on for a couple of hundred years. What I think we are seeing recently is our Republican friends taking this to a whole new level, which I think does raise a certain constitutional issues. And I think also what Arlene is talking about is now apparently some of our Republican friends are trying to devise ways that they can win elections without winning a majority support, are thinking of breaking up states into electoral districts, which will work to their advantage. So I think there is a significant role. Obviously, at the moment, this is mostly a statewide issue. But I think there is a role, certainly for the federal courts and for the Congress to contemplate. But Arlene, I apologize. At this moment, I can't tell you exactly what that remedy might be.
Dave in Paramus, New Jersey. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
I thank you very much, Senator. Good afternoon, and good afternoon to Tom, and I appreciate everything you're doing. My question has about six or seven parts. It's about the upcoming debt ceiling increase and the national debt obligations. If the Tea Party in the House, as threatened, does actually force our government into default by not allowing a temporary rise in the debt ceiling and payment of our legal debt obligations, if this was a corporation and it defaulted on some of its debt, the default is global and applies to all of the debt. It goes to zero and the corporation is at bankruptcy. If this also applies to our government debt, what happens to all of the $16.4 trillion of our debt? Does it become worthless? And if so, some of that debt is owed to Social Security, some to the domestic banking system, and some to the international banking system. What effect would this default have on them? What would be the new value of the U.S. dollar domestically and in the worldwide currency market? What effect would this have on the global banking system and global economies, including the U.S. economy?
Well, Dave, let me jump in and interrupt you because you've raised the right points. And the answer is, you know what, Dave? Nobody knows, because what our right-wing Republican Tea Party friends are talking about is absolutely unprecedented. Nobody knows the answer to your questions. But this I will tell you, and this is, of course, what you are suggesting. The results could be absolutely catastrophic, not only for the United States of America, but for the entire world's financial system. Think about it. The world's largest economy, the world's most powerful nation, for the first time in its history, defaults on its debts, does not pay what it is owed. This could bring massive financial instability all over the world. What the president has said, and I agree with him, is this cannot be something that you negotiate. There's nothing to negotiate. It is a disaster. It cannot be allowed to happen. Right now, the Republican brand, if you like, is sinking rapidly. More and more Americans understand that these guys, the right wing of the Republican Party, is way out of touch with mainstream America in terms of their ideas, their values, and what they're voting for. I believe that if they go forward and push this country into default, they will never, ever recover from that. Because what they will do will lead not only to financial instability, it will lead to more and more loss of jobs, higher interest rates, enormous pain for the American people. I think, by the way, that some of these guys are beginning to catch on to that and may be backing off. But this is not an issue that can be negotiated. It is an insane, disastrous idea. It must not happen.
Bernie, apparently we just have 45 seconds to the break. Apparently, Eric Cantor and John Boehner think that if they can keep bringing this up every 3 months, it'll give them an opportunity every 3 months to remind America that, in their phrase, Obama is borrowing money, or, you know,
right,
entitlements.
I mean,
are
they
a problem.
Really, that's right, Tom, and they really think the American people are very, very dumb, and I don't think so. Remember, here's the main point to be made: Mitch McConnell and these guys say that revenue is off the table. I want everybody to understand that today, at 15.7% of GDP, our revenue, the amount of money coming into the federal government, is almost the lowest that it has been in 60 years. So revenue must be on the table. There are progressive and fair ways to raise that revenue, and that's the way we create the jobs and deal with deficit reduction.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us for our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov, for a lot of great nationwide news as well as Vermont news, plus the Bernie Buzz newsletter.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives,
which is free and comes in email and has, it really is a great news source. sanders.senate.gov, 45 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Brunch with Bernie. Our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders answering your questions. Peter in Voorheesville, New York, watching on Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Senator Sanders. My question concerns a lot of your veterans in Vermont and myself. It's why our service-connected compensation rates already cut 50% of what they should be. I'll give you an example. 100% is $2,800, or $31 from $2,800, and therefore 10% should be $280. Well, it's actually $127. That's 4.5%, and that's less than 50% of what it should be. And 50% should be $1,400, half of $2,800, and it's $797. I'll wait for your answer, and I know there's a lot of veterans interested in this. Thank you.
Well, Peter, within a few days, I'm going to become chairman of the Veterans Committee, and this is an issue that I promise you we will look at. My immediate concern, by the way, Peter, is that if this so-called chain CPI being pushed by the Republicans and some Democrats go through, whatever disabled vets are getting now will be significantly lowered. There are folks who want to essentially move to a deficit reduction, not only by cutting Social Security, but by cutting veterans programs as well. But, Peter, thank you very much. And, by the way, if there are any veterans who are listening to the show, and I know there are many, please do not hesitate to get on the phone and tell me some of the issues that you are concerned about, and I will do my best to try to address them.
John in Ogden, Utah. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Senator Sanders. Thank you for your service and all your great ideas. I want to know how we can get the American people to realize that government is not a business. It is a nonprofit legislative body that is supposed to allocate our tax dollars for us and to benefit us and not, you know, pay for other countries, not pay for subsidies to big business. It's supposed to be investing in the country to make it better. You know, and I don't understand why we're electing CEOs and, you know, business makers when that's not what our government's supposed to do. We don't make a profit, you know, and I don't know how to get America to realize that. And once they realize that, maybe we can go towards universal health care, towards education for all.
Well, John, I got the question, and I think you raised an important point, and it gets back to an earlier question. And what you're really asking is, how do you make government responsive to the needs of ordinary Americans, which certainly is not the case right now? And that takes you back to elections. It takes you back to how do candidates fund their campaigns, which is primarily based on going out to wealthy people, and with Citizens United, a lot of third-party money and super PAC money is coming into the political process. I think few Americans would deny that right now we have a government which, to a significant degree, represents the interest of the wealthy and the powerful rather than the needs of working families. To answer your question, it deals with supporting candidates who have the guts to take on big money, who are going to fight for jobs for our people, who are going to fight to protect and expand the social safety net that so many of our elderly and kids depend upon, to deal with the trade issue right now and trade policies, which has resulted in corporations shutting down in America, moving to China and abroad, deal with issues like raising the minimum wage. We know what a progressive agenda is. We know what needs to happen to rebuild the middle class, rebuild our infrastructure, create millions of jobs. The problem is that we have many people, certainly the majority in the House, too many in the Senate, who worry about the needs of the wealthy and powerful and not ordinary Americans.
How much time do we have, Shane? Two and a half minutes. Time for another call here. Chris in Natural Dam, Arkansas. You're on with Senator Sanders.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. My question is, or first a statement, if there's millions of Americans who don't necessarily want a 9-to-5 job, they don't want to do a grovel at personal business to come up with all that money, and if the government cares about the people, why doesn't it share land so people can have communes and take care of themselves? People who don't want anything from the government. The government's got millions of acres of national forest. It just seems like the communal living for a lot of people would be a much better option than prison or drug addiction or homelessness. I mean, I think there's millions of people just don't want a 9-to-5 job.
Got it. Well, got it, Chris. Let's let Bernie answer.
If your thought is that there are people who would like to work the land, kind of, in a sense, live outside of the normal economy, and be self-sufficient doing that, and they need some help with some resources to get started on that project. You know, I think that is something that state and federal government, you know, can look at.
Okay, Bernie, we have just a little over a minute here before we wrap up the show today, or at this hour of it.
Let me just mention a few of the issues that are coming down the pike. Hmm. The most important issue is the debt ceiling issue, and everybody should understand that what that issue is about is Republican effort, along with some Democrats, to essentially cut back on Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, other programs, which will cause devastating harm to a whole lot of people. There are ways to do deficit reduction that are fair and progressive. One out of four major corporations doesn't pay a nickel in federal income taxes. We're losing a huge amount of money by companies putting their money in the Cayman Islands, Switzerland, and other tax havens. There are ways that we can raise additional revenue without causing more problems for people who are already hurting. And that is an issue that's coming down the pike very, very shortly.
Bernie, thanks so much.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great having you here. We will be back with Anything Goes Friday right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. It's Friday. It's Anything Goes Friday. Although Tommy Christopher is going to be dropping by, it should be entertaining. He has some very, very specific thoughts about half-cocked Americans. We will just leave it at that. But your call, CJ in Titusville, Florida. Hey, CJ, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Good to hear your show. I'm sorry, Miss Senator Sanders, he's the only reason I haven't totally given up on the Senate.
Mm. There's a couple good ones. Sherrod Brown's a good guy, too.
Yeah, there's a few, but I'll tell you, the 1% has got so many of them by the short hairs, it's hard to believe that things will really change. The reason I called is the creature from Jekyll Island. I know Senator Sanders has been working legislation to deal with these people. There is one outlier that was on C-SPAN. He appeared before the National Press Club on Wednesday, and his name is Fisher, and he heads the Dallas Fed. If you look at DallasFed.org, mm-hmm. He has a very simple proposal, and since he comes from that crowd, I was quite surprised to find somebody who was willing to go against the grain, against the rest of the Fed. And he has a proposal of how to end too big to fail, and what he's saying is reform it before it's too late.
Right.
You know, he realizes the 12 banks control 69% of all of the financial assets in this country.
I think he himself
is saying, here's a proposal, and I'm going to forward this to my representative and my senators. So it's on DallasFed.org.
Okay. I think it's fewer than 12 banks. I think it's like six banks are sitting on $7 trillion worth of assets, and our GDP is roughly $15 trillion. So.
Yeah, this is a guy you would want to head the Fed, but he has no chance, of course, because the big boys are still driving the bus.
Yeah, there you go. CJ, thanks for the heads up on that, and thanks for the call. Eric in Omaha, Nebraska. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
You're on the air, sir.
Yes, Tom. I'm wearing the Tom Hartman Program hat with pride here in Nebraska, as well as you know you have a lot of fans here.
Thank you.
My question is, here in Omaha, Walmart is opening these like grocery-only centers, and they have like 80 superstores. So wondering if Congress is going to do anything about companies like Walmart enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, companies like Home Depot, things like that. And my other question is, here in Nebraska, our Republican governor is proposing to end the sales tax here in Nebraska. I mean, ending any kind of sales tax sounds like a great idea, but is there something for the millionaires and billionaires if that happens? Thank you, and I'll take my call off the air.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Eric, for the call. With regard to ending the sales tax, it's kind of the opposite of what they're talking about doing in some of the other Republican-controlled states, where they're saying, let's end the income tax for everybody and the corporate income tax and raise the sales tax, because the sales tax is the most regressive tax. If you spend 100% of your income, then virtually all of your income is subject to sales tax, although some states exempt food. Or some other things, you know, they're taxed in different ways, gasoline, things like that. But by and large, you spend, you know, you're taxed on all of your income. So ending the sales tax, if you were replacing it with a progressive income tax, would actually be a progressive thing to do. So I'd have to learn more about, you know, what the issue was with that. And the other point. Oh yeah, Walmart in the Sherman Antitrust Act. Yeah, I wanted it. The enforcement of the Sherman Act, which is still on the books, and there have been, I believe, five, maybe six major pieces of legislation that have basically added to the Sherman Antitrust Act since 1881 when it was first passed. The enforcement of that is not up to Congress. I mean, Congress could pass a law both demanding and funding a more aggressive enforcement of it. But the fact of the matter is that it is the executive branch that carries out the laws that are made by the legislative branch. So Congress passes a law saying antitrust or trust combinations, monopolies are illegal, and then it's up to the White House, it's up to the executive branch to enforce those laws. And Ronald Reagan made a very clear decision, not unlike that decision made back in 1920, to basically stop enforcing the antitrust laws. And when Reagan stopped enforcing the antitrust laws in 82, we saw this explosion of mergers and acquisitions. This was, you know, right after AT&T had been broken up. That was the last really substantial action under the antitrust, Sherman Antitrust Act and others. And, you know, they're still on the books, and the executive branch still does the charade, the dance. You'll recall when General Electric and Comcast, there was some kind of a merger going on there that involved the acquisition of NBC. That went before the antitrust board. That AT&T and T-Mobile, I think it was, just merged. And again, you know, there was this question, will it be approved by the antitrust regulators? Well, you know, of course it will be. We have functional monopolies in this country in virtually every industry. And it's up to the White House to enforce those laws, and that might be something the next time you're writing a letter to the president or you're making a comment on the White House comment line that you might want to pass along, is please start enforcing the antitrust laws the way that they were enforced during the Nixon, Ford, and Carter years when AT&T was broken up. That was an action that was actually initiated by Richard Nixon's Justice Department, of all things. Jan in Green Valley, Missouri. Hey, Jan, what's up?
Yes, every Friday you give us an opportunity to spend an hour with a great independent senator. My question is, why aren't progressives fielding independent candidates in these solidly Republican districts when the Republican is pushed so far to the right by the primary, and we know they won't vote for a Democrat in that district? At the very least, it seems to me that we would end up with a more sensible Republican-type congressperson. And in a lot of cases, people who are going to vote feel really a pox on both your houses and would vote for an independent.
Well, there's a pretty straightforward answer to that, Jan, and it's that Bernie is in a rather unique situation in that he lives in a state that has 630,000 people in it. And I lived in Vermont for almost 10 years. I had some familiarity with Vermont and Vermont politics. And in fact, when I lived there before we started doing our radio show when we were living there the last year or so that we lived there. But up until that time, I had been to two Bernie Sanders fundraisers when he was representing us as our member of the House of Representatives. And, you know, in both cases, it was just, you know, show up. They was like a kegger sort of thing without the alcohol. You know, it was with apple cider. And, suggest a donation, $5 or $10 or something like that. Bernie does retail politics. He has probably shaken the hand of every single person in Vermont at least once in their lifetimes. And so he doesn't need the machine of a political party to get himself elected. In fact, Democrats run candidates against him, just like the Republicans do. But he is such a good retail politician. But if you're looking at New York State or California or Michigan or any of the other large states, you really need the machinery of a political party to be able to reach everybody.
Well, I really don't think that this will work, at least initially, on a statewide level.
Right.
I see it as trying to take back Congress. My point is that fundraising can be done online. We're always, as progressives, being urged to get out there and do the footwork. And anybody who doesn't do that doesn't know how much fun it is. And I think that progressives have to get over their attachment to the Democratic Party and field independence.
Respectfully, I think we need to amp up our attachment to it and take the damn thing over. I mean, here's this political party that has a 230-year-long history and has a billion-dollar infrastructure. And literally, if we decided to take it over, we could do it. You know, the Tea Party took over the Republican Party. I get your point, but I think it's going to be a lot easier to try to take it over from within than to try to fight it or ignore it from without. Jen, thank you for the call. It's 15 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything Goes Friday. And by the way, if you want to be a progressive Democrat, pdamerica.org. Not affiliated with the Democratic Party. Progressive Democrats of America. Welcome back to the Real People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Larry in Nutley, New Jersey. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to speak with Senator Sanders. I wanted to ask him about the prospects for the Arms Trade Treaty. As you probably know, even though it has nothing to do with domestic law, the NRA is going crazy and claiming that it's more of Obama's conspiracy to take away our guns, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, this is because the NRA is basically a front group for the weapons manufacturers, and they don't just sell weapons here in the United States.
Well, yeah, this is a treaty that would keep weapons out of the hands of criminals, terrorists, people that might use those weapons against U.S. soldiers, against U.S. citizens. So it's something that makes a lot of sense for U.S. national security, for people's human rights around the world. And right now, Senator Feinstein is circulating a letter that's going to President Obama about making sure that the negotiations at the UN in March show progress.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I personally, Larry, I don't know enough about it to give you an intelligent response. I will start keeping my eyes open and see what I can learn about it. Thanks for putting it on all of our radar screens and for listening to WWRL. John, listening on KABQ in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, John, you want to talk about teachers?
Yes, Tom. I wanted to, in response to Walmart's boast about hiring veterans at minimum wage jobs, I thought I should mention the Troops to Teachers program.
Tell me about it.
It's a nationwide program. You can see it on the Internet that looks at the talent that the veterans have, all the training they've gotten, their experience in the military, especially in leadership skills, and gives them credit for it towards their education degree. To get them into the classroom as quick as possible.
So this would be principally looking at commissioned officers, at people who are college graduates to begin with?
Oh, well, there are non-coms too, sergeants and, sorry about the noise.
That's
but others
right.
Who have that leadership skill.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
And,
who's running in this or sponsoring it or promoting it? I mean, is this a particular school or a state or a federal program? I don't know about this.
I think just a nonprofit, and maybe a collaboration of colleges and universities.
Mm-hmm.
It was founded at Louisiana State back during the Vietnam War.
Huh.
And, it's, just unsung.
Yeah.
And I thought you might want to interview someone about it.
Yeah, Troops to Teachers. I'm just plug that into the DuckDuckGo machine and it'll tell us all. I'm sorry? ProudToServeAgain.com, Shano says, is their website. John, thanks for the heads up on that. I appreciate it. And thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Steve in Bradford, Vermont. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, Tom. There was a story yesterday on MSNBC, little byline, and they didn't report it again, but they said that Germany is moving a whole bunch of their gold back to the homeland. I was wondering if you heard anything about that.
Their gold, G-U-L-D.
Yep.
Huh. I didn't know a bunch of their gold was outside of Germany.
Yeah, they said they were calling it all back from internationally.
Uh-huh.
It was in billions.
Huh. My personal guess is that the euro is doomed. And the euro is functionally the Deutschmark right now. I mean, it's basically the German economy has been holding together the rest of the European economy, and particularly the members of the EU that never should have become members, like Greece, are really, really being damaged by the fact that they don't have their own currency that they can devalue to basically get themselves out of the fix that they find themselves in, you know, as a result of the banksters robbing all of us. And this is becoming increasingly problematic for Angela Merkel and her Christian Democratic coalition. And so it wouldn't surprise me at all if in the next year, 2 years, 3 years, or, you know, conceivably even in the next month. I mean, this is the kind of thing that sometimes they just happened like that, you know, that the euro were to collapse, or, you know, one or two major countries like Germany or France were to say, that's it, we're out of the euro, which would cause the euro to collapse. And in that case, then Germany would want to have all their sovereign gold on hand to use in part to back a redenomination of the Deutschmark. But right. I can't, you know, this is all speculation on my part. I don't know about the specific news story that you're talking about.
It was a very small, you know, just byline on that. You know, they didn't make a very big thing of it. That's
right.
But kind of gave me a red flag.
Right. Yeah. And the other thing is that the U.S. Fed has now said this was one of those stories that pretty much nobody except the gold bugs noticed about, I don't know, 2 months ago or so, that the Fed has said that they're going to stop having inflation be their number one priority, and they're going to equally prioritize inflation and jobs, which is code for, we're going to allow inflation to devalue the value of the U.S. dollar so that the government can pay off debts with cheaper money, with less valuable money. And as the value of the dollar goes down, of course, the value of commodities will go up, and gold being the principal one. So, you know, people who are into gold were noticing that like it was a giant blinking neon sign. But I think pretty much everybody else was like, well, you know, so what? Isn't jobs a good thing? Well, of course, it's a good thing. And frankly, inflation, when done appropriately, reasonably, and in small doses, is a good thing, because it does allow the country to pay off its debt with cheaper money. But it also works to the disadvantage of working people, inflation by and large, particularly people whose jobs are not indexed to, whose income is not indexed to inflation. And the fact that our Social Security cost of living adjustments and other COLAs of this whole variety of them don't reflect real inflation is it's a real problem for the United States. So, you know, I'm kind of two minds about that, you know, what the Fed should be doing. But the fact of the matter is that it looks to me like we're going to see, you're going to see the euro unravel. You're going to see the U.S. and world economy crash probably in the next couple of years. And you know, out of that, hopefully, will come a new economic order. We're going to see something like we saw in 1932, 33, 34, where the rules get reset. But, you know, anything could happen. I could be totally wrong. But that would be my guess on that, Steve. Thanks a lot for the call. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And check out our new app, the Tom Hartman Program app, where you can read our blog every day and check out your podcasts, all kinds of cool stuff. It's free. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio and TV Program. Tommy Christopher on the line with us. He is the media correspondent and White House reporter for Mediaite. Mediaite.com, and also a dear friend. Tommy is one of God's great people. Hey, Tommy, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Tom. And of course, I feel the same about you.
Bless you, brother.
Top quality human being you are.
Thank you. So now we've done our mutual appreciation. I got to tell you, tomorrow you've got a great post over at Mediaite.com. about how tomorrow is Gun Appreciation Day, and there's some strange sponsors for this thing. Tell us about this.
Yeah, well, first of all, I have to give credit to Media Matters who flagged the big one, which is this this party called the American Third Position Party. They are a white nationalist party, and they are a sponsor of Gun Appreciation Day.
Third Position? This is not something out of the Kama Sutra.
Yeah, you know, it's the first thing I was thinking, but that makes sense, because I think the Republican Kama Sutra only had three positions.
I see. Okay. Well, and to that point, another one of the sponsors. Did you make this up? I mean, you've got this graphic on here, the Half-Cocked Academy.
No, the Half-Cocked Academy is absolutely real, and I thought that really just summed up the whole event, because you know, I it seems like whenever any of these pro-gun people talks about what's happening these days, the legislation that's being proposed and the executive actions, that they really are just kind of going off half-cocked and not knowing what they're talking about.
Yeah, well, I thought your note, you know, not to make light of a serious medical condition, but if you were among the ranks of half-cocked Americans, you'd probably be clinging to your stockpile of guns, too, was brilliant.
I probably could have kept it a little bit more highbrow, but I'm me.
So. Hey, you know, it's like, it's Gun Appreciation Day. I mean, it's... but the it's serious
more overcompensating than that, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Seriously, though, you know, I get a lot of hate mail and death threats and whatnot anytime that I go off on guns. It's really hit a peak in the last couple of weeks, although it seems to be dying out now that pretty much everybody's talking about guns. But the white nationalism, you know, last week I published a piece over at truthout.org. It's still up on their website. Titled The Second Amendment was ratified to protect slavery, because at the ratifying conventions, Virginia was the key vote. If Virginia went for ratification, we would have the United States of America. If they didn't, we would still be the Confederates, or we would still be the states operating under the Articles of Confederation. And this country wouldn't be anything like what it is right now. And three Virginians, James Madison, actually, James Madison wasn't so concerned about it. He came up with the solution. But Patrick Henry and George Mason were just, you know, freaked out about the fact that Article 1, Section 8 gave the federal government the authority to call up state militias, because the militia in Virginia, like the militia in South Carolina, North Carolina, and Georgia, was basically the slave patrol. In fact, in Georgia, it was called the slave patrol. I got just got a copy of it a couple days ago. This brilliant book called Slave Patrol that this woman wrote back in the 90s. That just, you know, this whole history of this stuff. And
yeah, I think I wrote a post about that yesterday. It was very interesting stuff.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that the white nationalists, you know, if the Second Amendment has a strong piece of its history. Now, it's not, obviously not the entire history. You know, I think the main reason it originally was put in there was because Jefferson wanted us to not have standing armies during times of peace. It's why in the Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, the only thing that Congress can only appropriate funds for a two-year period or less is the military, the army specifically. They can appropriate money for Social Security for 75 years, for 100 years, for 1,000 years, but the army only 2 years. And it was because many of the founders were very wary of a standing army, but they thought that a local militia, basically every state having a national guard, like Switzerland does, would be a good solution, a good remedy. So that was the original intent of the Second Amendment. But the Southern states had a whole different take on it. And if there's like this slavery piece of it, then white nationalism seems like, you know, being attached to the Second Amendment seems to make a lot of sense. I'm curious what kind of feedback you've gotten on your piece here, and, you know, conflating white nationalism and people who are opposed to gun control.
Well, actually, to tell you the truth, I haven't really had a look at the comments section. I kind of try to avoid it. It's not usually a pleasant experience.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that, you know, the point to me isn't so much that, I can see how if I was a gun advocate, I would feel like, oh, well, you're trying to make it seem like we're all racist. But I think the real point here is that the pro-gun fringe is so unhinged that they're not at all discriminating in who they let stand with them or who they stand with. You know, they're so desperate, you know, to get attention, and they're so unhinged in their hysteria over the Second Amendment that they're just not paying any attention to who they're standing with or who's standing with them. Or maybe it's more sinister than that. I don't know. I try to think good of people.
Yeah. Well, and me too. But it's
I prefer to think that they're ignorant and rather than evil. So.
Yeah. Yeah. How is Gun Appreciation Day playing out? Are there going to be are you covering any gigs or events? I haven't seen any press releases coming across my desk about it.
No, I've got family stuff planned all weekend, but I mean, I am curious to see how it turns out because I think that the expectations might be kind of high after that Chick-fil-A Appreciation Day, which made quite a splash on the national media. You remember that every CNN, every channel had these lines around the block at the Chick-fil-A's. And I don't know if Gun Appreciation Day is going to be able to repeat that success. And if you can't match the enthusiasm of a Chick-fil-A, then I'm not sure what you really got going for you.
Yeah. Yeah. The NRA has been bragging that they've added 100,000 members since the Newtown shooting. But that's in a country of 230 plus million people. That's very few people.
Oh, well, Tom, if you're, while you're talking about it, go to my website. I posted another article today about an investigation that Mother Jones magazine did into their membership numbers that accuses them of vastly inflating their numbers, and it's very compelling.
Hmm. And an awful lot of their money is coming from the gun industry, basically. They're fronts for the gun industry.
Yeah, okay. Well, no surprise there.
Yeah. Tommy Christopher, he's writing over at Mediaite, MediaIte.com. Check out his article, White Nationalist Party Among Sponsors of Gun Appreciation Day is the one we're talking about here. Tommy, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Thanks for having me, Tom, and you have a merry Gun Appreciation Day. Something good.
Well, thank you. I will do my very best, and the same to you, Tommy. We'll see you on the TV machine one of these days. Amazing. Okay, John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I think I've heard you say, and maybe I misunderstood you, but that Stephen Helmsley makes $1 billion in compensation total in a year.
No, I never said that.
He's the highest paid exec in the country.
Yeah, he might be. My understanding is that Dollar Bill McGuire made, who was his predecessor at United Healthcare, made $1.78, as I recall, $1 billion in total compensation over a decade.
Oh,
and,
I see.
And Helmsley replaced him, must be maybe 7 or 8 or 9 years ago. And at some point a year or so ago, it was announced that Helmsley's total compensation, which would be all his stock options and everything, plus his salary and everything, had exceeded $1 billion. So
okay, well, anyway, that's an interesting, point, and I believe it.
I first read it in the Wall Street Journal,
He is also very influential in this community, and I just looked him up just to see, what it was that, exactly he made. Just his salary is $3.2 million, but
right.
More importantly, he is on the Board of Trustees of Minnesota Public Radio. And, we've had one senator here who for years wanted a single-payer, option health care. And I think it's really gotten short shrift, from the powers that be. They did one of their very academic little jobbies in the morning, their morning host, and just kind of poo-pooed it. I just don't think they gave it a fair hearing. I think it's great. I wish that I might be moving to Vermont when I retire. But anyway, also, I noticed that out of the 14 trustees of Minnesota Public Radio, there is, I think, 12 of them come from Fortune 500 companies. Hmm. There's just an incredible amount of corruption all around. I really thank God for Free Speech TV, for you, for Amy Goodman, and for anybody else who's really independent and really trying to, speak truth to power, because I think eventually you're going to win, or we're going to win, but, we're up against some really big obstacles. It was just a revelation to me that, the Board of Trustees consisted of no ordinary people. There were two people on there that One was, I think, the head of the Department of Education at the University of Minnesota, and maybe a few other people, but, yeah. but majority...
Well, it's not uncommon for charities and for public radio stations to be looking for wealthy people to be on their boards.
Don't you think that
that's part of their fundraising base?
It has an influence. I mean...
Oh, hugely.
You know, I don't think there's a firewall between what they say on one side in the news department and the people that they, you know, cozy up to. Yeah.
I would say it's a soft firewall, John, but I can't speak about to or about Minnesota Public Radio. I know nothing about that. But just in general in the media, there's kind of a soft firewall between who's advertising or who's paying the bills and, you know, what's happening on the media. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So what are you going to do for Gun Appreciation Day tomorrow? Do you have festivities planned? Hot dogs on the Barbie? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in on with the news, with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat and help a rescued slave. GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. And Victoria Jones on the line with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, I've got a story I'd like to share with you before you begin, because this,
yes.
If you don't mind, this falls into the, well, what could go wrong category.
Yes.
Tell me if you know about this. Lapeer, Michigan, the Chatfield School, public school.
Yes, it's my final story. Please tell.
Okay. Well, you know the story then. After the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, they decided to hire an armed guard. And so they hired a guy who was a former retired Lapeer County Sheriff's deputy. And in fact, he was a firearms instructor.
Yes.
And by the third day, this was Wednesday, he had left his handgun in the student's bathroom, unattended.
Yes.
What could go wrong? What could possibly go wrong? Armed adults in schools. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just so.
Yes.
It just is.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry I couldn't inform you. You are so ahead of me on everything, but I had to try.
No, it's just great. I mean, it tops the second grader in Queens who went to school with an armed gun in his backpack yesterday or Wednesday.
Just in case, right?
We don't know why he had the armed gun in his backpack. Maybe, I don't know, they decided to arm the janitors at in one school board. Maybe now they're going to arm the second graders. I don't know, she said sarcastically and
yes.
Not really reporting the news.
Okay, well, let's... Now you got everybody laughing over here. All right, so to reporting the news.
Reporting the serious news.
Yes.
In Algeria, one American worker at the natural gas complex in Algeria has been found dead, U.S. officials said today. As you know, the Obama administration is trying to secure the release of Americans still being held by militants. It's the third day of the hostage standoff. The officials identified the dead American as Frederick, I think it's pronounced Butaccio. He's a Texas resident. It's unclear how he died. They've recovered his remains and have notified his family.
That's
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has spoken by phone with the Algerian prime minister to get an update and on Americans and on others in danger. She has said that the utmost care must be taken to preserve innocent life. She also has defended Algeria's action, said, let's not forget this is an act of terror. The perpetrators are the terrorists. They're the ones who've assaulted this facility, have taken hostage Algerians and others from around the world as they were going about their daily business. A slightly different reaction from the reaction of some of the other countries who have reacted with various degrees of irritation to straight-out anger. The Obama administration is being more cautious in its response. What it's saying behind the scenes, of course, is different. But I've done a bit of research on this, and it could be that Washington is feeling that if it too aggressively criticizes the Algerian response, it risks squandering a year's worth of unprecedented diplomatic outreach to Algiers on counterterrorism in this part of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this was apparently now confirmed to be a branch or a division or a a splinter group or a simpatico group of Al-Qaeda.
Yes, it's an offshoot run by Mokhtar Belmokhtar, an Islamist militant leader. He was a member, then he split off, formed his own group. He is known as, respectively, One Eye, the Marlboro Man, and the French know him as the Uncatchable.
Interesting.
He funds his operations through cigarette smuggling and kidnapping.
Therefore, the Marlboro
Man. A battle-hardened militant, and would have known that the Algerians would respond in this way.
Very interesting. What else is going on? Is it true that the Republicans are probably just going to give Obama a 3-month extension on the debt ceiling so that in 3 months from now they can have this conversation all over again and keep reminding the American people that we're running debts?
Yes, this is a fascinating story. They have decided to introduce a bill next week in the House to increase the debt limit for 3 months, but also required the Senate pass a budget before agreeing to any longer-term increase in the limit. And there's a twist. The twist is that if either chamber fails to adopt a budget by April the 15th, members of Congress would not be paid. Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, and John Boehner. John Boehner said no budget, no pay. We're all touting this morning, and it went very well for about 3 hours until Representative Daryl Issa, one of your favorites, head of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, said that's unconstitutional.
Oh, really?
He says it will fall afoul of the 27th Amendment, saying no law bearing the compensation for the services of the senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened.
You're absolutely right. So they can affect congressional pay for the next a year and three quarters from now, virtually 2 years from now, the next Congress, but they can't do it until the 2014 election is over.
Right. So he has another plan. He wants them to introduce something that was introduced by Dick Gephardt in the 80s, whereby the debt ceiling would be increased to the amount of new spending allowed under the budget resolution, known as the Gephardt rule, but it does require passage of a budget to be implemented. That's what Daryl Issa is pushing for.
Does anybody have a budget on the table other than the one that that Paul Ryan put forward that shreds Medicare?
No, but the House intends to introduce another budget, which will be, I think, equally stringent. And the Senate actually is probably going to have to do something about it, because the American people understand, if sunlight is put on this, the American people will understand that if you haven't passed a budget, you haven't passed a budget. No matter how the Senate Democrats pass it, it doesn't look good.
Right. And the one budget that the White House proposed when it went to the Senate was defeated 98-0, as I recall.
Right.
It basically all the Democrats voted against it, too, which seemed to me like really, really bad strategy.
Right.
Yeah. Very interesting. Well, keep your eye on this one. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. And, of course, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, Ellen Ratner's charity that Ellen put together and is doing great work in South Sudan. We'll be back with your calls on Anything Goes Friday right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
In the in the what could possibly go wrong department in Lapeer, Michigan, the Chatsfield School District took the advice of the NRA and hired an armed guard, former deputy sheriff, firearms instructor, who left his gun in the boys' bathroom, not in the staff bathroom, in the students' bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and, a pigeon alert, the National Pigeon Association. Now, this is these things have, by the way, they're talking about the planet Xenu in the New York Times today. But it's in the context of Scientology, so I think they got it wrong, because they didn't mention pigeons. I don't know why. Anyhow, the National Pigeon Association is having their big show and convention, and they're showing off pigeons. I think this is just an example of people who are being controlled by pigeons, because we know that pigeons are robots from the planet Xenu sent here to spy on us. And the way you know that, of course, is you never see a dead pigeon and you never see a baby pigeon. Right. And if they were real, you would see dead pigeons and baby pigeons. And instead, all you see are robots. And what happened, you know, whenever you have, you know, world leaders, people who can change the course of history getting together, what do you have out on the street in front? Pigeons. Right. What do you have in the windowsills? Pigeons. Under the roof, under the eaves. So, John in St. Paul, Minnesota, listening on AM 950, Minnesota's progressive voice. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Phil. Great show, as always. My question, could you talk a bit about the Federal Reserve, the national debt versus the deficit? Isn't it true that, would you be in favor of dumping the Federal Reserve? And isn't it true if they were dumped that we'd instantly save 25% of the national debt? You understand my question?
Yeah, well... maybe, maybe not. If my preferred course would be to nationalize the Fed, to put it under the Treasury Department. And so as a consequence of that, the interest that the Fed earns, instead of going to the Fed, would go into our own coffers. We'd be paying interest to ourselves on our national debt, which basically allows us to issue debt at no cost. And you know, I think that would be a good thing if it was done reasonably. And countries have been doing that for centuries, for millennia. Occasionally it gets unreasonable and things get out of control, but generally it's fairly reasonable. So, you know, that's how I would do it. And I think the other big banking change that I would make is I would encourage every state to emulate North Dakota and come up with a state bank and take all of the state funds that are, you know, which is trillions of dollars if you go, you know, the entire United States, and have that state bank handle those funds, whether it's pension plans or whether it's checking accounts or savings accounts or whatever it may be. For example, in California, back when they had this horrible deficit that was left over by Republican Schwarzenegger that has now been resolved by Jerry Brown, getting everybody to vote on a tax increase for rich people. But that deficit that the state of California had was less than the amount of profit that Wall Street banks make handling California's money for them. So if California had a state bank that charged the state fees and interest for doing the things that the Wall Street banks are doing right now, the revenue from that bank would pay, kick enough money into the state of California that there'd be no debt. And that's as far as I know, that's true of pretty much every state in the union. So I would encourage every state to create their own state bank.
Such an obvious solution. Why isn't that pursued on any level?
Because banking is probably the second most profitable industry in the United States behind fossil fuels. And therefore, you've got, you know, banksters who have mind-boggling amounts of money. It's like, you know, why weren't the big banks broken up when they crashed in the last year of the Bush administration? Or for that matter, why didn't Obama do them in the first year of his administration? There was a fairly narrow window of opportunity. I think it would have been much, much more difficult for Obama because the big decisions were made two sequential bank bailouts and two stimulus packages were passed under the Bush administration in his last year in 2008. And that was when it was pretty much put in cement that we were going to keep in place the banks that we had. But, you know, why weren't they broken up? Well, they weren't broken up because they basically own all the politicians, and the ones that they don't own, they can terrify. And, you know, there's very few out there that they didn't. I mean, Bernie Sanders, Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich were the ones who were running around going audit the Fed and let's do something about this. But, you know, it's just not going to catch fire with the mainstream politicians because there's too much money at stake. And until
the Federal Reserve, and if that were done, as you suggest, would that instantly alleviate, say, $4 trillion of the national debt that is owed to the Federal Reserve? And thank you.
You're welcome. I don't know that you would want to wipe it off the books because, and thank you, John, for the call. One of the reasons that the government issues debt, and I believe it's in the Constitution, although my copy of the Constitution has floated over to the desk next to me. I can't reach it right now. But I'm pretty sure that in the Constitution there is some reference to the debt being available for people to use for, thank you, Jim, for purposes of savings. I'm going to have to dig through this because I'm not sure exactly where it is. It would make sense that it's Article 1, Section 8, but I'm frankly not sure. It might be Article 4, 5, 6, something like that. But that one of the reasons why we issue debt is so that our citizens will have something that they can invest in that is absolutely safe. So there is some kind of gold standard of safety, as it were, for investment. And if we were to pay off the national debt entirely, as you hear Republicans talking about, which we've never done in the history of our nation, then it would be impossible to buy a treasury bill. And people who want to save money would be, you know, up a creek. I mean, it would be a bad thing. It would actually be a bad thing for the United States not to have any debt at all. It would be a bad thing for us. It would be a bad thing for people who want to invest in America. But the question is, when the federal government pays interest on its debt to its debt holders and to the issuer of the debt, you know, right now the Fed is taking a piece off the top of that. Shouldn't it be the Treasury Department? Shouldn't we be issuing our own currency? I think we should. Sam in Greenville, Kentucky. Hey, Sam, you wanted to disagree with me?
Yes, sir, I am. The disagreement about when you interviewed that person
Tommy
before and talking about the white nationalists and stuff, you know, mm-hmm. where basically you all labeled anyone who supports the Second Amendment as either racist and hopefully ignorant of evil.
No, not at all. I did not.
That's what he said. That's what he said.
Well, I didn't hear Tommy say that either.
Ignorant.
What he was...
He said he hoped that people, those for just hopefully ignorant instead of evil. I heard him say it.
Okay, yeah. And, well, what he was talking about, just for the record, what he was talking about was not the Second Amendment. What he was talking about was this the two of the sponsors of Gun Appreciation Day, and one of them is this white nationalist party, and the other is the Half-Cocked Academy. And the Half-Cocked Academy, he was just basically making fun of their name, but the white nationalist party is one of the sponsors of Gun Appreciation Day, and they are a group they're white supremacists. They believe that America should be a country that's only white people have rights in this country.
Well,
and they are one of the official sponsors.
I totally disagree with that thing. But, you know, the point I want to make, don't they also support Planned Parenthood? Didn't I read where they supported Planned Parenthood as well? Because,
who is they?
They're the white nationalists.
Oh, I don't have any idea.
About two-thirds of all abortions are in minority communities.
No, they're not.
And that they supported that.
They're not. Sam, you're wrong. There are... The white people are the majority of people in the United States. White people are the majority of people on food stamps. White people are the majority of people on welfare. White people are the majority of people who get abortions. And, you know, it's fairly simple, straightforward math. I know black people have been characterized in those ways as, oh, that's them. But it's not. It's us. It's us white guys. Sam, thanks for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday right after this, 15 minutes past the hour. Your opportunity to support your local station. Okay, so let me, you know, I mentioned the Permian extinction a couple of days ago. I just want to mention it one more time because somebody called earlier and mentioned, you know, burning things, and I was talking about contemporary sunlight versus ancient sunlight, and it's really just the last 150 years that we have been using ancient sunlight in a big way. It's the last 1,000 years that we've been using it, but it's just the last 150 years, and it's really the last 50 or so years that we've been putting so much of it into the atmosphere that we are reinventing the atmosphere to be the way it was before the Permian extinction. The Permian extinction was a period of time 250 million years ago when there was apparently a lot of volcanic activity in what is now Siberia, which heated up the planet by 5 degrees Celsius. That in turn heated the oceans, which in turn melted the methane hydrate crystals around the seacoasts. Hundreds of billions, maybe trillions of tons of methane frozen under the surface of the sea, decomposed plant matter, decomposed aquatic plant matter. And that methane bubbled up. This is the soda pop hypothesis. That methane bubbled up into the atmosphere. And I read about this in my book, The Edison Gene. In fact, there's a chapter on this. And and added another 5 degrees of global warming, because methane is an incredibly potent greenhouse gas. That total 10-degree warming of the planet was enough to kill off 95% of all life on this planet. 95% of all life in the oceans, 95% of all life on land. And what came out of that was the dinosaurs. They appeared after the Permian extinction. And then, of course, they got knocked out by the Earth being struck by a meteorite that's, you know, stuck in the ground down near Cancun. And that was 65 million years ago at the end of the Jurassic period. But the Permian extinction, 95%. What we know about that now is that endogenous, you know, within the Earth forces, this massive volcanic activity produced the first 5 degrees of warming. And then the second 5 degrees of warming, well, it was also endogenous. It was also came from the Earth, but it was a consequence of the sea warming up and all this methane being released. Well, all that methane is back in the sea again. It's been 250 million years since the Earth was that warm. So it's all back down there as methane hydrate. In fact, there are some oil companies that are trying to drill out some of it. And one of the projections is that if we keep burning fossil fuels the way we are, by the end of this century, we will have warmed the planet by 5 degrees Celsius. And that is a bad enough thing in and of itself. I mean, Australia right now is in flames as a consequence of global warming. But if that then triggers the soda pop, the methane in the oceans, to warm the planet at another 5 degrees, we will see the extinction of the human race. And that's not good. At least that's not good if you're a fan of the human race. And I am. And of, you know, all the other life on Earth as well. So that's that. Jim in San Clemente, California, you wanted to talk about the Second Amendment and slavery?
Yeah. You know, I had heard that theory floated around about the Second Amendment ratified to empower slave owners, and it had nothing to do with individual rights. And your name is all over the Internet as the chief proponent of it. So I took the time to look up the study that you're referring to, the hidden history of the Second Amendment.
Yeah. Yeah, by Dr. Carl T. Bogus.
Right. If I were to tell you that there were no evidence to support that, it was all circumstantial, what would you say?
I would say, by and large, you're right.
That's what Bogus says himself. And
yeah,
I
know.
Looked it up, and I got page.
I know. There's no evidence for any theory about why the Second Amendment is there that is not circumstantial. I mean, I could point to you the letters from Jefferson to Madison in 1787 when Jefferson was in France and Madison sent him the first draft of the Constitution. And Jefferson wrote back saying, you know, I will tell you, you know, he goes through the things he likes and he says, and now I will tell you what I do not like. And he said, what I do not like is that there is not a Bill of Rights attached to this. And then he goes through the specifics of the Bill of Rights, that the press shall be free, that there shall be freedom from religion, that there shall be no standing armies during times of peace, and that there will be no monopolies in commerce. That was what Jefferson wanted in the Bill of Rights. So, you know, under that, and that argument was made repeatedly, no standing armies during times of peace. It's why in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, you can only appropriate funds for the army for a 2-year period. They were very, very wary of standing armies. And so I'd say that the main reason why the Second Amendment was put into the Constitution, and in fact, the original reason, if you read the first four drafts of it, Madison's first four drafts of it, the very first one actually had a sentence in it that said standing armies at times during times of peace are pernicious, was to stop that. But let me just finish this thought and I'll toss it back to you. The key was when Virginia had to ratify the Constitution. The North and South, they were both agreed standing armies were a bad thing, but they had enough votes to ratify the Constitution, except they still needed Virginia. And this is when Patrick Henry and George Mason came forward with the quotes that you can find. If you look at the article that I wrote, it actually links to the actual quotes where these guys said, wait a minute.
I read that.
Okay. From the point of view of Virginia as the linchpin of making it happen, the Second Amendment was slightly rewritten to take out the part about standing armies and to, instead of talking about a free country, which was the next to the last draft that Madison had written, to make it a free state. Now it's yours.
I read what you wrote, and I've read the studies. Can I get one word in edgewise?
You may have an entire minute.
Thank you. What the strongest reason for the Second Amendment? Can we give an authority on what the strongest reason for the Second Amendment would be?
Well, the strongest reason clearly was to prevent a standing army.
So Jefferson, the strongest reason for people to retain the right to keep and bear arms is as a last resort to protect them against the tyranny in government.
No, that's a quote that was made up. If you there's an entire website that will give you the misattributed Jefferson quotes. Jefferson never said that.
Patrick Henry, you want me to keep going? So that quote was made up by Jefferson.
No, Jefferson never said that.
Okay, how about this quote? Like most Americans, I believe that the Second Amendment guarantees an individual right to bear arms. Who's the right wing nut that said that?
I have no idea.
President Obama.
Yeah. I mean, this is how the Supreme Court has reinterpreted it in the Heller decision and others, that there is an individual right to bear arms found in the Second Amendment. I don't see that there, and just because the Supreme Court says it doesn't mean it's right, although it does mean it's the law. But Jim, I personally believe that there were two principal reasons. The main one was to have something to prevent a standing army during times of peace, and the second was to get Virginia's vote for ratification. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And in fact, over the weekend, I'm going to write another piece on this with a little more follow-up now that I've got Sally's book, The Slave Patrols. The Slave Patrols have an amazing history. Hey, it's inauguration weekend, and tomorrow night, Saturday, my friend Stephanie Miller is bringing her live comedy show, the Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour, to the Warner Theater here in Washington, D.C. Here's some of what goes on in the show.
Thank God I was too ugly to be used as a campaign prop in my dad's 1964 campaign. Yeah, you've seen me, the little wolf cub. I'm my friend, there's the official campaign photo. My dad's holding me in his arms, and my friend looked at it once, and she goes, Jesus. They just would have dubbed in a sack of potatoes. He might have at least carried Idaho.
So to all of you out there who are coming to D.C. for the inauguration, there's more information about tomorrow night, Saturday night show at sexyliberal.com. And all of us at the Tom Hartman Program are going. Louise and I will be there. We hope to see you there. It should be a lot of fun. And I just saw the most amazing picture over on Democratic Underground. It's one of the top threads right now, one of the top trending now threads. Titled LBJ Made Clear Where He Stood When It Came to the BFEE. And it's a photo of Lyndon Johnson and George McGovern, and LBJ has hair down to his shoulders. I mean, literally down to his shoulders. He had let his hair grow. And George McGovern asks why. And this is the article by Leo Janos in The Atlantic back in 1973. This was written, and the photo was taken. Apparently, the last days of the president, LBJ in retirement. I mean, this was written after that. But this was so Johnson suffered the election in silence, swallowing his nitroglycerin tablets to thwart continual chest pains, endorsing McGovern through a Hill County weekly newspaper, meeting cordially with a candidate at the ranch. The newspaper showed a startling picture of Johnson, his hair almost shoulder length. Former aide Bob Hardesty takes credit for this development. Hardesty says, we were working together one day, he's talking about him and Lyndon Johnson, and he said in passing, Robert, you need a haircut. And I told him, Mr. President, I'm letting my hair grow so no one will be able to mistake me for those SOBs in the White House. Lyndon Johnson looked startled, so I explained, you know, that bunch around Nixon, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, they all have very short hair. LBJ nodded. And then Mr. Hardesty says, the next time I saw him, his hair was growing over his collar. And here's this photo of LBJ, and George McGovern, and his hair is down over his shoulders. And LBJ, keep in mind, went to his grave. Oh, you found the photo, Jim. Good job. LBJ went to his grave knowing that Richard Nixon had committed treason. Treason! To make him president, that LBJ in 1968 had actually negotiated peace in Vietnam. This was halfway through what we call the Vietnam War. So, you know, half more or less of our soldiers and of the millions of Vietnamese who died wouldn't have died had he been successful. He had negotiated peace with the South Vietnamese and the North Vietnamese. And then Nixon contacted the South Vietnamese, Madam Tu, and said, if you'll hang on until after the election, I'll make you rich. I'll give you a better deal. Well, you know, we can negotiate the same thing, but I'll make you rich and just, you know, just hang on until after the election. The CIA wiretapped this. It was one of the campaign guys working out of New Mexico. The CIA wiretapped it and gave the tapes to Johnson. And so Johnson, LBJ, calls up his old friend, Everett Dirksen. Johnson was the Senate Democratic leader. Everett Dirksen was the Senate Republican leader and one of the most honorable men in my lifetime in the United States Senate. And he was a Republican. And he calls up Everett Dirksen, the head of the Senate Republicans, and breaks the news to him and says, we can't tell the American people about this. They'd lose faith in the system. But you've got to tell Nixon he can't do this. This is treason. And here is that phone call.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico. And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
And Everett says, I know. And, you know, later on in the conversation, Everett Dirksen says he promises that he's going to talk to Nixon. He's going to try and solve it. And there's several of these conversations. I mean, these were just released 2 years ago by the LBJ Library. And I'm just astounded that they didn't make, you know, front page headlines in the New York Times. Richard Nixon takes White House. Republicans take White House by treason. And, you know, it just astounds me. Just astounds me. And that's without even getting into the whole October surprise thing. Anyhow, Keith, in Arroyo Seco, am I saying that right, New Mexico, listening on KBOT?
Yeah, this is Keith McHenry.
Hey, Keith, you're on the air.
Okay, yeah. Well, one thing is interesting is my great-great-grandfather was Dr. James McHenry, Secretary of War under Washington and Adams, and he argued for standing army under Washington, but he refused. Finally got appropriated money for 20,000 troops under Adams. But the real reason I'm calling is that we're starting to see another wave of local governments trying to stop us from sharing free food. And we were approached by the police and ordered to stop in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, just before Christmas. Mm-hmm. And we're currently in a struggle in Burlington, Vermont, where there's a threat of stopping us this Sunday.
Who's we?
Normal meal there.
Who's we?
And we're starting to see that this is increasingly happening.
Keith, who is we?
We is Food Not Bombs. I'm sorry.
Food Not Bombs. Okay. And the website is foodnotbombs.org. Is that right?
.net. Yeah.
.net.
And we, and it's in the past 12 months, this is over about 38, 39 cities have passed laws against sharing free food outdoors in public.
Right.
And we've actually been holding off arrests in places like Houston and Philadelphia, where they have made these laws, but they, fortunately for us, the authorities haven't come out and enforced them.
Remarkable. Remarkable.
We did have problems in Orlando where we had 24 arrests a couple of years ago. And then I did 2 years in jail in San Francisco for feeding people in the 90s.
That's incredible. You know, this really ratifies Daniel Quinn's concept that he lays out in his book Ishmael, that the original sin of humanity was locking up the food. Was, you know, the agricultural revolution made it possible for one person to control the food supply and put a lock on the door. And that led directly to kingdoms and empire and rich people and poor people and all these other things. And that's brilliant. Foodnotbombs.net. Keith, thanks for the report. Keep up the great work. Good to hear from you. Matt in East Jordan, Michigan. You had a question about the Department of Justice?
Yeah, well, I did. First, I wanted to note that I have, in fact, seen dead pigeons. And my John Bircher father, when I was a child, he used to actually bait our garage and then slam the door and then wring their necks and we'd eat them.
Oh, my.
So they're...
Okay, that's hard to, you know, usually when people say, I've seen a dead pigeon, I tell them, oh, that's a cleverly painted dove made you to think that it was a pigeon. You know, the pigeon, that's how wily they are. But that's a tough one to rebut. So I'll just leave that out there. So what about your question about the Department of Justice?
Well, anyway, this morning on Cost, I believe, I noticed that a couple of Michigan legislators, state legislature, are considering changing the way that Michigan allocates its electoral votes to a proportional system.
Right.
And my question is, if all these upper Midwest states and Virginia move in that direction more or less simultaneously, is there anything the Justice Department can do when you've got something such so blatantly obvious as a way to rig an election?
No, there's not.
Well, this is a disaster.
What I know. Hey, this is something that the Koch brothers and Alec and, you know, these right wingers, this is what they cooked up back in 2008. In fact, who knows? I mean, this might have even come out of that meeting at the Caucus House restaurant on January 20th, 2008, the night of Obama's inauguration, or 2009, that would have been. But what it was 2010 is a census year. Every 10 years, the Constitution requires that there be a census, and then following the census, districts are redrawn in each state. And whichever party controls the state legislature and the governor's office can make sure that the districts are drawn in ways that are advantageous to that party. It's called gerrymandering. It's been going on since the 18-teens. And so they poured all this money into these five or six major swing states that have historically always gone Democratic, but there are large enough Republican areas that they figured they could gerrymander them. And they did it. They got control. And this is how Kasich got in. It's how Snyder got in. It's how Scott got in. It's how Walker got in. Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Florida. And Pennsylvania, Tom Corbett. And now that they have gerrymandered those states so that they are sending, even though the states are overwhelmingly Democratic in terms of majority vote, they're sending a majority of their actual members of the House of Representatives, are Republicans because of the gerrymandering. Now they're saying, and by the way, instead of doing this winner take all for the presidential, the Electoral College, we are going to send, you know, we're going to change the way we do this so that we send our electors based on congressional districts. And the Constitution is relatively silent on this. It basically says that, you know, it defines the Electoral College, and it says that this is not the exact language, but the essence of it, that each state can decide how they're going to determine who their electors are and for whom they will vote, that they send to the Electoral College. So this is entirely legal and incredibly pernicious, malicious, mind-boggling. So, Matt, I share your outrage, but I don't think there's anything we can do about it, and except for, you know, get really, really mobilized for the 2014 elections.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if 2014 goes down as midterm elections typically do, with minority parties doing really well, that being the Republicans, then 2016, there is going to be a Republican in the White House, even with a minority. Welcome back, and thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Shane Farnan, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our phone screener, Danielle Gilday, to our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the people at our various syndication companies, the people who carry our program, Dial Global to commercial stations, Pacifica Radio to non-commercial stations, CRN Network on cable networks, Free Speech TV on Dish Network and DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, and others, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ella Ratner, Victoria Jones, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, and to our affiliates, our underwriters, and you for supporting our program. Thank you. Sincerely, thank you. Dwayne, in Petaluma, California, you wanted to talk about the Constitution?
Yes, but first, you just mentioned Nixon's treason.
Yes, sir.
Ford would have to have known about that.
Jerry Ford, yeah, I believe
even, even before he pardoned him.
Yeah, I believe that is probable.
What I called about, though, was the interpretation of our Constitution in terms of replacing the Articles of Confederation. There was no effective method in the Articles of Confederation that the slave owners could force the return of their slaves if the people in the northern states didn't act to return them. That is, the court system set up under the Articles of Confederation is very different from what we
right. There was not a federal judiciary for all practical purposes, and so one state couldn't enforce a national law against another state. They could only do trade agreements with each other under the Articles of Confederation.
Right. So the Constitution was in large part supported by people who were interested in preserving their slave rights.
You're right.
And the people who were voting
at least those people in the South. There were people in the North who supported the Constitution because they wanted to have a strong confederation, a strong nation. And they were and they were very vehemently opposed to slave rights. Massachusetts had outlawed slavery before the ratification of the Constitution. Vermont had outlawed slavery before they even joined the other states. I mean, they weren't one of the original 13. But
If you take it that way, the Bill of Rights was proposed by the people demanded in return for conveying additional powers on the federal government. And if you
that was Jefferson's argument.
Is that the people who were voting on it or telling their local representatives to vote on it were basically seeing it as opposing the power of the federal government or limiting the power of the federal government.
Yes.
And that's the way the Bill of Rights should be viewed is pushed by the people, and it should be interpreted as being.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And that's what Barack Obama said before his first election when he said the bill, you know, the Constitution is a bill of negative rights or a bill of negative, I forget the exact phrase he used, but
I would
basically it's there to limit government power. And that's why Virginia was saying we will not ratify this Constitution unless there is a Bill of Rights attached to it, which includes an amendment that says that our militia can remain under our control and can remain armed, because the armed militia of Virginia was what enforced slavery in that state.
And I would ask, if we are going to give additional powers to the federal government, we seem to be doing this every day, shouldn't we be working on increasing in terms of a Bill of Rights that is more specific at protecting the people against the government?
Unfortunately, that cat is long out of the bag, Duane. In fact, I'd say ever since 1803 and Marbury versus Madison, that cat's been out of the bag.
Okay.
It's gonna take some real activist political stuff to bring America back to rationality. The last time around, we've had two revolutions in modern history. In American revolutions. One was in 1932. It was the FDR New Deal Revolution, and the other was in 1981, and it was the Reagan Revolution. And frankly, I think that we need another FDR New Deal Revolution, and I also think that it's not going to come about unless we have another 1929-style crash. And I expect one to happen, and I expect that it'll produce that kind of a result.
And I hope Obama can lead change his leadership style and can take a page out of Roosevelt's book.
I share your sentiments. Duane, thank you for the call. Stan in East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Stan. Climate science?
Thanks, Tom. I just have my pet argument that I use in forums with climate change deniers. I just want to share it with you. I'll try to be fast. The Earth and Moon are both 93 million miles from the Sun. They both get 1,400 watts per meter squared illumination. The Earth, though, is 66 degrees warmer. Why? Well, the Moon actually absorbs more light than the Sun, so that's not the reason for it. So, of course, it's the atmosphere, which Joseph Fourier figured out in 1826.
Mm-hmm.
What's giving us the greenhouse effect? It can't be the oxygen or the nitrogen. They can't absorb and re-emit infrared back towards the Earth.
Right.
It's only the 99.5% of it is O2 and N2. So there's only this very small part that comprises these triatomic molecules like CO2, nitrous oxide, methane. But 99.5% of that is actually CO2. And to get an idea how much it is, I have to say that if you squeeze all that atmosphere to the bottom of the atmosphere, of course we have miles above our heads, but if you squeeze that part that's doing the heavy lifting, that's only about 3 meters. It's only about 10 feet.
All the CO2 in the atmosphere, if it was concentrated as pure CO2, would be 10 feet worth of CO2 distributed over the entire planet. That's fascinating.
Yeah. So it's really not that much. It comes out to 800 gigatons.
Yeah, it's coming in closing in on 400 parts per million. Stan, we're out of time, but thanks for sharing that. That's brilliant. Coming up Monday on the Tom Hartman Program. Monday's the big dance here in D.C., President Obama's inauguration round two. It's also the day our nation celebrates the birth of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and it's the third anniversary of the disastrous Supreme Court decision, Citizens United. So we're going to take them all on. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get involved. Progressive Democrats of America's got a gig here this weekend, too. PDAmerica.org and SexyLiberal.com. Check them all out. We'll see you. See you Monday. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.